Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So it's great to have Judith Peel on tonight. I'll introduce her briefly. She's a writer and an art dealer. She lives in Melbourne. She's got degrees in arts and anthropology and is currently doing a PhD on the broad topic of federal funding of arts in the 20th century in Australia. But she's here really relating to the publication of her book, Unskilled Art, Art, Politics and Living with Clifton Pugh. So the topic tonight is art and politics in the 1970s.
Is that okay for that? Yes. In 1975, Bernard Smith, the Australian theorist and historian, wrote an almost perfect essay entitled Notes on Elitism and the Arts. The essay was addressing the question of whether and how the arts should be subsidised with public funds. And he wrote it because Clifton Pugh was disputing funding models with Nugget Coombs. I want to begin with this very particular question and some of the arguments around it, and then go on to put it in the context of the wider issues with which Clifton Pugh's work engages, and which engages now, to allow you to compare and contrast those exciting times, the 1970s, with these. Smith's essay begins by reminding the reader of the origin of elitism. Elitism was originally a theological concept that the gods choose and favour certain individuals. The notion began with the Greeks and was adopted by the Jewish and Christian religions. Smith dryly examines the manner in which inspired creativity became a badge of the chosen few. For the Greeks, poets and musicians were the gods' chosen artists. During the Renaissance, first painters and architects, then sculptors were added. Then Castiglione made the argument that aristocratic behaviour, chivalry, I suppose what Jane Austen calls condescension, was in itself inherent rather than learned. Smith goes on to explain that Nietzsche elevated the artist himself to the status of a god, born with a creativity that is of itself moral. And that this was the idea, artist's idea of themselves in 19th century Australia. He points out, however, that elitism first arrived in Australia in a different form. The inspiration of the people building mechanics institutes and galleries and encouraging art education at the time was art as an aid to civilization, to morality, to good behaviour in general. But he points out, such ideas about the dignity of craft did not prevail in the Australian art world. He suggested in that raw, provincial, mainly pastoral 19th century society, it may have been a matter of survival for art's sake. Aestheticism became the order of the day for visual artists. Aestheticism contains two forms of elitism, he argues. It's tutored artists to claim that the appropriate audience for their work was of people born with a good eye or natural taste. He wonderfully calls this the luck of the gene. Certainly this is a claim one heard in the 70s and still hears now. The other form of elitism Smith called professional elitism, that you had to be a trained artist before you could be a judge of art. This is, I think, the flaw in the gem that is this essay. These are not true sides of a production-consumption equation. That would be if an inspired, untrained artist made work that only could be appreciated by an inspired audience. But I'll return to the question of elitism, first to put the debate in context. The Whitlam government was elected in 1972 with the support of many artists. With surprising energy, made the reform of federal arts funding one of its immediate priorities. When I say surprising, I speak as the person who designed the campaign that gave the appearance of a spontaneous upsurge of support for the ALP from artists of all persuasions, dancers, actors, playwrights, painters, singers, musicians, in every state. And I'm the person whose tactics to persuade a reluctant Gothican to take on the arts portfolio tied him firmly to the arts constituency. Smut seems something of a claim in these days of massive advertising campaigns and spin. So let me describe a moment in 1974. A couple of weeks before the election called by Billy Snedden, when he threatened to refuse the ALP's government supply, a journalist telephoned me asking if I had any Whitlam stories, because the Age had 7 Snedden stories and it was going to look unbalanced. I had no formal position in the ALP, but the journal knew me from the 1972 campaign. I rang the Assistant Secretary of the State ALP branch and asked, "Who's doing a media liaison?" And he replied, "That sounds like a good idea." You won't be surprised that I was doing it that very afternoon. In 1970, when I met Clifton Pugh, he had agreed to chair a committee to develop an arts policy for the ALP. He painted right and left, as it were. Harold Holt, the Liberal Prime Minister, had been his friend and subject. Cliff had no personal issue with visual arts politics at this time. He joined the ALP to oppose the Vietnam War. The political economy of the Australian art world was simple. Everyone in it took for granted the interdependence of artist and buyer. Apart from scholarships and a very few prizes, and the assistance on occasion of patrons, that small world was entirely about sales. On occasion there were questions about prizes, favouritism, but there were very few controversies. The issue for visual artists was not grants or residencies, it was purchase. To be taken on by a dealer or sell from the studio or in a show with the Society of Artists. The prestige of having the picture in a public collection or official exhibition helped, but the focus was on private or occasional corporate sales. 1970s Australia was still a post-war society, in the sense that most of the men who controlled it, the politicians, industrialists, academics, the officials of clubs and societies, sporting associations, of hospitals and unions, and hotels and small businesses and banks, had seen service during World War II. At the beginning of the decade, servicemen also dominated the art world, as officials of public galleries or collectors, artists or dealers. But the art world was that part of society most susceptible to change. So already some women were prominent, European refugees were influential, and hierarchies not rigid. At the time, most Australians sought spiritual sustenance through the large number of churches rather than the small number of art galleries. I talk about art world. I think Bernard Smith is right about the central ideas that drove the market in the 1970s, and yes, he was right that trained artists filtered and graded work into categories and by giving advice to dealers, to collectors and to each other, managed the perceptions of value and of price and of work. But the art world was rather more democratic and fluid than that would suppose. One thing you could be in it and of it, and neither make nor buy art. It was a liminal place, where artists mixed with musicians, writers, actors, academics, and businessmen, where ideas were freely debated, where connections were horizontal, across race, and despite class. It was louche, a place where divorce was accepted, and adulterous liaisons tolerated, and homosexuality, and even casual dressing. The end of Bohemia, those years were before art became a mainstream activity. At the time, politicians, federal politicians, were central to the art world. Since 1911, when Prime Minister Andrew Fisher set up the Historic Memorials Committee, and that committee appointed and met regularly with the Commonwealth Art Advisory Board, artists had influenced the official image the nation presented to the world and to itself. The Commonwealth Art Advisory Board always consisted entirely of professional, trained artists. In the 1960s and to the early 1970s, the board commissioned or bought all work for embassies, high commissions and other official buildings, chose sculptors and sculpture for Canberra, managed numbers of international travelling exhibitions touring Australia, even chose the Prime Minister's Christmas card. It was one of the biggest players in the art market, nationally and internationally. And respect was respected within the art world. Clifford Last, Fred Williams, James Gleeson, and Len French were on the board. They joined Bill Dargy, knighted, as was Darryl Lindsay, for the work he'd done to build a national collection and toward a national gallery. with Douglas Pratt, Robert Campbell and Sir Russell Drysdale under long, staged chairmanship of Will Ashton, the board had driven the plan for a national collection adopted during Sir Robert Menzies' years in government. Prime Ministers Holt, Gorton and McMahon had increased the board's funding and continued its executive powers. Because the board was so respected, no one in the visual arts really disputed the status quo. In so many ways, it was a time before theory, except, of course, the Marxist dialectic, the opposition of capital and worker, and to be an artist is in capitalism, to be a manufacturer. Social realist artists thought the state should support artists and everyone else on a wage, but they too had exhibitions with work for sale. Always an irony, watching a social realist at his opening. Thus, Gibb had been reluctant when Firehold, a Victorian Parliament ALP leader, asked if he would chair the policy committee. But Clive was insistent. He was hearing from actors and playwrights, composers and musicians who wanted a policy that would develop an Australian voice. Gibb was also worried because politics is compromise. He'd made a life where he could do what he wanted, want it when he wanted. Clive replied that the committee consisted of all of the ALP members who even thought about the arts with the same views. No one in the ALP at the state level would interfere, so the policy they developed would become federal ALP policy. And it did. Gibb agreed to take the chair. If Australian visual artists didn't think much beyond the status quo, many in the performing arts did. Their industry funding was not controlled by professionals, but by the chairman of the Reserve Bank, H.C. Nugget Coombs. Members of Cliff's committee were hostile to the Elizabethan Theatre Trust and to Coombs, whose Federal Arts Council controlled all national subsidies except for literature, the visual arts and composers. National arts subsidies. Bernard Smith made the point that the idea of art as uplifting and educational was displaced in the visual art market by the notion of aesthetics. But it seems to me that such ideas formed Coombs' approach to funding the arts. This was consistent with the funding of the Australian Broadcasting Commission at the time, and the ABC and the Trust co-funded projects. So Coombs' official subsidies were perceived to be skewed to high culture. When the recipients of his council's grants engaged at all with the experience of ordinary people, it was almost always to educate or improve them, ready to develop vocal voice. The Elizabethan Theatre Trust, of which Coombs was also chair, was the sole channel through which tax-deductible donations to performing arts could be made at the time. A donor could not even specify that the donation be for a specific project or theatre company. Apart from the one day of the year in the summer of the 17th dole, subsidised theatres mostly staged British and, rarely, some European or American drama. I've spent most of my life working with the visual arts, but in Sydney in the mid-1990s, I ran a small publicly funded chamber opera company which commissioned and produced Australian Music Theatre. It took me some time to understand the sense of panic and confusion I had in this most interesting job. It's because my culture is that of the visual arts. Paintings are material objects. If you don't sell a picture, you still have it. And in the course of time, as your reputation grows, the ones you still have increase in value. There's an understandable sense of urgency in theatre. Theatre is bums on seats, an event. It happens in time. It's a different risk from making paintings or sculpture. A production fails, you'll have sets, costumes and a script that have to start again. The actors on the policy committee didn't want to do Shakespeare or Rattigan. They wanted investment in playwrights and theatre companies producing local work about local subjects. The policy developed by the committee was to establish an arm-length funding body run by art form committees of professionals and to import the visual arts model to the other arts. It was using public money to fund seasons for local drama, not first nights for old favourites. It was also about community arts and not about elitism. And this, too, was to be a critical factor in Cliff's later disputes with Nugget Coombs. The policy in place, the question arose, how to ensure the ALP was elected, and if that happened, that the arts policy was implemented. There would be more urgent items on the agenda in ALP government. The arts budget is infinitesimal compared to social security or education, but it is vulnerable to the argument that it is soft, useless by comparison with these vote-winning and weighty matters. While Cliff painted Wickham's portrait, I had the opportunity to persuade Wickham to take on the Arts Ministry so as to ensure its budget was protected in ministerial bargaining. Wickham refused repeatedly over some weeks, but I devised a plan. My plan would make the ALP look connected to the culture, even possibly hip. The issues that attracted artists to the party were much the same as those attracting the broader electorate in 1972. sentiment against conscription in the Vietnam War, the power of the state of government schools, the idea of Medicare, the under-resourced support of the outer suburbs, and yes, even then, the environment. We had a good grounded arts policy. I could organise supporters in the arts community to come out gradually and support the ALP. Whitlam, instead of the shadow minister, would announce one section of the arts policy. On hearing the announcement, an artist would turn to journalist and photographer conveniently located at their elbow and say that this commitment meant that they would vote for the ALP. Whitlam would see the support bill. Once he agreed to the arts minister, I would organise this support for each other policy. Artists would ally themselves with Medicare or environmental issues and so on. I asked Whitlam to let me try the strategy. He didn't believe it would work, but to stop me arguing for it, he made the deal. If I could make it worth his while, he would agree to be Minister for the Arts. The strategy, as you know, had an astonishing effect. It was as if popular culture became one with the aspirations and hopes of the post-war generation and focused on the ALP. Whitlam saw the point and agreed to take the arts portfolio. I wanted to make this point again. It was a very carefully organised plan. It was a deal. It never occurred to us that Coombs would continue to have any part in the arts after the 1972 election. There would have been no arts campaign for the ALP. In the records of the Commonwealth Art Advisory Board before 1972, you can see Nugget Coombs coming. Letters arrived from the Arts Council with requests for figures asking what is spent on the work of which artist or project. Bill Dargie, the honorary chairman, begins to be drawn into meetings of the chairman of Commonwealth agencies, where the first item on the agenda is to clarify the responsibilities of the various Commonwealth agencies operating in the support of arts in Australia, and is beforehand to produce a paper setting up the functions and activities of the Visual Arts Board. But the records show that Coombs could not get past the Magisterial Prime Minister's Department, nor his forays into management of the Visual Arts School at Holst. If you make a deal in politics, it is well to know who else is dealing with your partner. Soon after the election, to the horror of the directors, playwrights and actors who stood up to support him, some risking their careers on television and radio, and without discussing it with me or anyone involved with the strategy, Whitlam announced that Nugget Coombs would be chair of the reformed Australia Council, and to our horror, that Cliff would be on it. My culture is the visual arts, Whitlam's politics. He later wrote that Cliff wanted to be Australia Council chair, far from the truth. Cliff wanted to paint. It has slipped Gough's mind that Cliff was appalled that it was expected to be on the council and initially refused. He finally agreed to attend a few council meetings for the look of it in order to reassure his committee members that their work had not been in vain. He was sure there would be professionals on the board and that there would be a community arts board. This had been spelled out in the policy for which I've done the deal. For some reason, probably because of the state fund's local voice, may find itself funding dissent, or at the very least, satire, the idea of practitioners in control of arts funding boards was anathema to bureaucrats. As Coombs in the early 1970s organised a meeting to discuss the setting up of an inquiry into the crafts in Australia, and I quote from the minutes, "It was the view of the meeting that special crafts interests should not be represented on the committee. An advertisement inviting membership of an arts body will invite expressions of interest from individuals with an interest in the art. The modes of community representation, I'm all for it in moderation, but I look for the day when the Meat and Livestock Corporation, or the CSIRO, or the Reserve Bank, or the Australia Post, or the Telstra Board look for board members with an interest, rather than professional expertise and experience in their industries, in addition to the usual suspects of law and accounting. My experience of artists of all persuasions is that by virtue of the satisfaction their work provides, they are focused, committed, practical, efficient, and tight on a quid when it comes to administration. They plan carefully, deliver on time. How could you not for an opening night or an exhibition? They don't need to be pretentious. The measure of their success is not by the clothes they wear, or the cars they drive, or where they live, but by the judgment of their peers and of history. This may or may not be a material success, but they have to have a long-term view. As I recall those dramatic times, I remember a particular event. The playwright David Williamson and Cliff were both appointed to the Australia Council by Gough Whitlam. The Williamsons were our neighbours, and David and Cliff were constantly complaining about Gene Battersby, the council's executive officer. Thinking perhaps it was a question of personality, but they all sat down to a quiet meal they might find common ground, I invited her to dinner. David and his wife arrived in their new Peugeot. They had built a big, comfortable Mudbury house nearby. They've owned, I think, 5 houses at the time. David had played in the West End and had a London exhibition coming up. I'd made sure the food was delicious, and then Pip had his best wine forward. As the others looked at Pip's latest pictures, I asked Jean what I could do to bridge the gap between her and these two rich, independent men, internationally recognised at the height of their professions. And she told me that artists were incapable of managing their own affairs and would really help if Pip and David could be made to see it. Pip fought angrily for the appointment of arts professionals to the council and boards and for the community arts, and frustrated, resigned in 1975. You might wonder why a named painter, as the phrase was then, would bother with the community arts. Ignored by Coombs, Whitlam kept talking about excellence and excellence in the arts. Bernard Smith makes the point that talking about excellence and offering it to everyone may appear democratic, but it reinforces the notion of an elite. If one makes grants to artists who already achieve what is already regarded as excellent, how can it be argued that funding is necessary to achieve excellence? Bernard suggested that if excellence is the aim, we need to develop a democratic mode. He suggested we look at sport, pointing out that Australian achievements in sport came from the ubiquity of cricket, tennis and swimming in the community, while cultivating and encouraging the rest. That we began with a broad democratic base. Elitism fails, he concludes, because it insists on a narrower base. Its apex fails to reach the limits of the possible. My subject is art and politics in the 1970s. For Cliff and me, art was long, and politics in the party sense, short. Our involvement with the ALP ended in 1975. However, when I turned to reflect on Cliff's art, his work before 1970 and the remaining years of that decade, I am surprised how much that work resonates with wider political issues we grapple with today and with current issues of art politics. Because he won the 1971 Archibald Prize with Sir John McEwan and the 1972 Prize with Bob Whitlam, and then began to promote the arts policy, he's often regarded as a painter of politicians. He made friends with and painted a number of other ALP figures, but portraits were only part of his practice. They are particularly interesting because he had a capacity to record what he saw and let the viewer make the judgment. This was true too of his self-portraits and those of his family and his wives. He was impeccably honest in paint. We see ourselves and his attitude to himself and to us, unreserved. I hesitate to call the non-portrait paintings landscapes, because that implies distance and scene. Landscape in Australia is the fauna as well as the view, the vista. But until Cliff's pictures, natural history was not drawn into Australian art's work. He's better described as an expressionist who lived in the bush and explored the desert and the outback of Australia. His early reputation was made from a series of exhibitions which were not discussed in political terms, probably because in Australia at the time, political meant party political or ideological. In retrospect, one can see that the paintings were canvassing what were then radical ideas as well as exploring form and technique. But they were admired as original paintings, brilliantly executed. The event depicted might be mentioned, but it's not its deeper meaning. He travelled around Australia in the early 1960s and painted a series of pictures on the theme of St Francis. His St Francis works among Aborigines clothed in Hessian, outcasts in poverty. He travelled to Mexico. The penitence pictures are of savage Holy Week ceremonies, bleeding figures scarred by cacti, mindless self-destructive religious devotion. The anti-war movement brought Cliff into active politics, but his long-term focus was the issue of protecting the indigenous environment. An unlikely military experience set apart from his political stance that he would consistently elaborate through his work and public persona. Captain Jock Marshall, a Northern ornithologist, recruited crack shots with artistic talent as forward scouts in a New Guinea jungle. In the morning, they spied for the army. In the afternoon, for science, they drew the bird of paradise. When ex-Captain Jock Marshall was appointed professor of zoology at Monash University, he and Cliff renewed their friendship. Marshall and his colleagues began to teach the artist about the science of the environment, the degradation of natural resources by pollution from cities, by farming, mining and recreational practices, and the spread of settlement. Scientific research confirmed Cliff's own observations. His paintings were already exploring the fragile relationships he observed in the bush and the desert of flora, fauna and natural environment. His paintings reflected his observations of the effect of exotic imports on indigenous creatures or on the environment itself. In the mid-1970s, Duke painted a series of pictures inspired by Ivan Smith's radio play Death of a Wombat, which was being published as a book, and he followed it up with another show based on Smith's Dingo King. The Age newspaper promoted both books. The drama of Death of a Wombat resonated with the public. It is about a sudden, devastating bushfire after drought. I think that through these exhibitions and their huge publicity, Duke gave Australians a way of looking at the bush and the desert and their creatures that helped bed down the environment movement. He also took part in several Derek television documentaries, taking a cruise on location in the desert and the bush. Remembering that colour television arrived with the Whitlam government, incidentally rendering it the excitement more vivid, these documentaries brought his images and their inspiration into people's homes, and his work was in great demand. However, he had another political statement to make in this regard. The least prolific of his contemporaries, he kept his prices low in comparison to theirs. He wanted ordinary people to buy the work for their enjoyment, not for investment. It was about communicating ideas, not making money. He did make money a lot, but he kept the price of his work within normal bounds. He wanted enough to live on, provide for his sons, and to seek to endow Dunbar Churches where he lived in perpetuity for the benefit of the environment and creative artists. He lived for a further 10 years after I left. He bequeathed a large and valuable area of land, his house, and a series of studio dwellings in perpetuity for artists to rent cheap living and studio space in a unique, environmentally sensitive area, and he set up a foundation to support that complex. Curiously, these principles and his endowment have contributed to a diminution of his reputation. Art politics today is more and more about text and less about image, because curators are no longer mostly artists, and artists are less and less on the boards of institutions. His work does not come onto the market, it stays in families. Bernard Smith talks of elitism. Smith struggled with the idea of himself as especially chosen, being a part and against the marketing of his work in this way. He did not target sales to institutions nor seek the approval and support of academics, and as there is not a great body of work in any institution, they don't see his work in order to evaluate it, so it's difficult for it to form the basis of a paper, a book or a career. Now that writing about art, evaluating it, is no longer by trained artists but by art historians and curators, reputations are filtered through different values and artists are elevated for different reasons. Kiff never intended to be useful to curators in that sense. He did not care about making a history book, because he thought history could take care of itself. There is also another element that keeps Kiff's work in a historical grain shadow. We see now the globalisation of the environment movement itself and its expression in economic and management language, its climate change. But for Australians, the amount of carbon in the atmosphere and whether or not it affects climate is not the only issue. Kiff's narrative remains uncomfortable because it makes us face the detail, the reality of what we do to the natural environment. Already in 2009, we've seen images of fire and flood and drought that force us to consider how to live here in harmony with the space beyond our cities and towns. His paintings are about the delicacy of the Australian bush and the life cycles within it. They're balanced. They're about the destruction of that fragile environment by the intrusion of settlement, both historic and by continuing pastoral, urban and industrial expansion. They are a visual accompaniment to the complaints of Indigenous people, and they pose the same question. How do we adapt and change without losing what is precious? Their allegorical references to the large issues of human behaviour pose uncomfortable questions about the way we deal with each other. We have to find these answers to these questions. And I wonder if, as we do find our way to a balance, these pictures will come back into view, bringing the most important idea of all, that commitment and creativity and facing the truth are what make a great picture. Thank you.
Janet Grundy's got some copies of I'm Still Light, Art, Politics, and Looking into the Flip Computer, which has recently come out. And so we come to question discussion. We'll finish no later than 7 o'clock. You've made a strong case for to be on artistic boards, but One night after politics, I mean, should they be back in the studio? Because what you seem to be suggesting is that your experiments with getting Whitlam in and failed completely because none of Coombs arrived, and this was only resolved when John Kerr sacked the Whitlam government and peace was restored to the artistic community. But just tell us a little bit about it. I know it's towards the end of your book, Clifton Pugh's relationship with John Kerr. As I recall, he was painting Kerr as Governor-General really in the period just immediately before they left for November 1975. He obviously formed an opinion about Kerr. So just talk a bit about his relationship, his opinions about Coombs and his opinions about Kerr.
When I was living with him, one of the very frustrating things about living with him was I came to see very early that he could tell you exactly what someone was like, but what he could do is not sort of describe their thought, but he would know, he would see aspects of them and always be accurate. So you'd want to know, you know, will somebody think someone, how will they be or whatever, when you're, I don't know, I'll be thinking who I put together. And he'd say, well, so-and-so's was always very focused. And he came home, we started, and when he started painting Kerr could not have been more affable, more friendly, and he came, I think that Cliff went up there first, and then found it difficult because it was easy for him. Early on we found that I could talk to somebody and they'd forget the fact that they were being painted, so they'd relax, that was better for him. So Kerr came down, we had a day when he was very, very affable. Then Cliff went back up to Canberra to continue working on the picture. And David Smith came into the room and said that Whitlam had said the Governor-General will do what I tell him. And Cliff came home to me that night and said to me, he's going to say Whitlam. Well, it was only 3 years, so I knew he couldn't. And I said, that's silly. He said, no, he's going to sack Whitlam. And I said, no. He said, he's going to sack Whitlam. And I said, did he say he's going to sack Whitlam? He said, no, I saw it in his face. You see, for him, it was a fact. So it became bizarre. We didn't go straight up there. We had to go back to Canberra, and we had an appointment at 11 o'clock on the 11th. And so, well, it can't be, actually. I keep thinking that. But in fact, it was. I don't know what he was... I mean, surely the Governor-General should have been doing something else at the time. But anyway, we had an appointment that morning after all that. And I drove the picture up to Canberra. Cliff flew up to an Australia Council meeting. So I drove the picture up to Canberra, and then we were driving back down to take it back and have our next. And one of the things that kept happening in the painting, and that's why he brought it down to have a go, there was this curl of the lip that kept appearing. And he said to me, I want you to watch when I'm painting and see if his lips curl. And I said, it's not. I don't know. And he said, I can sew it. And it just kept appearing. And he'd take it out. And then he'd be painting and he'd come back. It was so weird. And then, so there it was. It was sitting in, we were staying with Clive Cameron. It was sitting in his room waiting for us to take across to Government House the next morning. And I rang up, I'll tell the story. I rang and said to David Smith, oh, that's right, on the Friday night before we came down, Maximilian Walsh said, we met and we're all having a drink with all the friends, and Maximilian Walsh started to drink, and Cliff started to drink very heavily. And Max kept saying, Fraser knows something, he's got a lot of Valium. He's very, very calm. And Cliff said, Whitlam's going to sack everything. And we said, well, Kerr's going to sack Whitlam. And everybody at the table said, no, you know, the Governor-General doesn't have those. And Cliff said, no, that's what he's going to do. And nobody would listen to the poor man. So we came back down to Canberra, and on the day, Cliff got the picture out again, and he said, why are the curls still there in the morning? He said, I don't know how I do it. I've just got to take it out. I'll have to try and finish it today, and then I won't touch it again. And, of course, by that stage, I rang David Smith. David Smith said, well, do you mind? I said, I don't know if you know what's happening today. Well, brother, he says, I think he's going to be a half centre. I brought him a message from top earth. So I knew it was going to be, and I knew with them, therefore, we'd be going to the government house. So I said, yes, I do. And then, so Sue said to me, well, in that case, you'll know that the Governor-General has a lot of writing to do. So we'll have to put you off until this afternoon, but you'll probably need some friends then. And I said, oh, fine, you know, you're on the phone. How profound a odd conversation. I looked differently. So I rang, I forget who the Attorney-General was. I rang his office. And I said,
Kev Enderby,
that's right. I said, can I speak to Kev? And his secretary said, well, Judy, he's in a cabinet meeting, I'll get him out. And this kept happening quite often during this whole thing. I felt, and when I look back, I was a very brilliant political strategist. But I saw myself as this nice, smart, this man. God, I'll be bringing this man, the Attorney General of Australia, out of cabinet meeting. So he can give me a lecture on the fact that the Governor General, for some reason, the Constitution has to handwrite. So I said, oh, don't worry. And so that night, of course, when Pip came back that afternoon, he got incredibly spectacularly drunk because, of course, he was the one first to know. And he was sort of elated, very strange. And, of course, there was the pictures on television that night pointing to the curve of his lip. I had the curve of his lip. Now that you said to ask about now too. Well, he got on perfectly well with that. But when he looked back, he kept on getting out of his book involvement when he was having difficulty with him. He just found him, he kept saying, look at the hands, look at the way I painted, I should have known, look at the hands. And they are very sort of grasping. He always got something about the person he was painting.
So this is the curved portrait on the front.
That's
of
the curved portrait on the front of the book.
So how did he end up with the curved portrait? He went back for some more sittings?
That was the last sitting, yes.
Well, I guess Kurt is dismissed because he didn't study law at Melbourne University. No one told him he couldn't do what he
wanted.
Sydney University, yeah.
Okay.
You said something about there's more text being published or subsidised by the Arts Council than painting at the moment.
I didn't actually mean about the Arts Council. What has happened? What Bernard says is that it's inappropriate, you can't say that trained artists know about art. But in fact, of course, you can. And Bernard has proved it. He was an artist before he became a writer. And all of the best writers about art have been trained about artists first. I mean, Gleeson, Elderly, they were people who could write really brilliantly. And the reason is, we now know, that visual art, when you train somebody as a visual artist, you're actually training a different section of their brain. I've lived with them for many years, I've been an art dealer. I rely on the advice of artists as to which is the best picture in a show or something. It was my very early observation that we would go to an exhibition with Fred Williams and Ned French and John Brack and all of these artists, and they would always focus on one or two of the pictures, and these would be the interesting picture to them in the show. And it would always be the same one. And so when I had a gallery, when I started my gallery, which is partly curiously, I used to ask artists formally, because by that stage, when you had a gallery, you were being sent slides, and there weren't slides on Keystone. And so you'd get these slides in. And so I used to have everybody in for a month, every month, and we'd look through everything that had been sent. And it was manifestly obvious. You could get a heavy metal sculptor, a very delicate little printmaker, about 22, somebody who did very rich, thick painting, somebody who did watercolours, and they would all say, all of them would say, that one is good and that one, and they would be looking at sculptors. And it didn't matter. So I believe that the training that you ought to have, I actually think that art training ought to be like the Courtauld Institute training is for, if you want to teach somebody about running or writing about art, you ought to do the way you do in the Courtauld. In the Courtauld conservation degree, you come in and if you come in either with a science degree or a fine arts degree, a history fine arts degree, and they train you in the one that you haven't got. And I think that you shouldn't be allowed to write about art, really, until you've done both.
I don't know if you published your book, so I hope I'm not doing you offensive. But I've got a project at the moment to read books published by the Arts Council, because the ones I'm getting from the library are unreadable books. And I'm wondering who are judging these books.
Oh, I see what you mean. Mine's not unreadable.
It's
very readable. Very readable. Publishers out of the number. This is very unsettling.
They're completely satisfied. Can I just say, I'll read something?
I'll have any questions. But you would then an answer.
All right, fine. I suppose what I mean is that our politics at times, at the moment, you see, because there is so much more interested in having residencies and artists are made to, and particularly curating, because there are a lot of exhibitions, public exhibitions, that then get funded as exhibitions that then travel around, this has to come with text. And so text begins to drive it. And because there are actually a sort of oversupply of curators and people trained to do this sort of thing, then they have to make a career. So they start off with somebody. I mean, it's a sort of, I don't mean this is sinister, but it's how it happens. You get interested in a particular artist, you become the expert in that person, naturally you want to promote them, and naturally you want to show their work, that you want, you think that their work ought to be moving around the country all the time. And you get a job running a particular gallery, and you think you ought to be showing them all the time. Of course the artwork is much bigger, but there was this extraordinary overview.
Just before I call Anne, I agree with what you said about art critics, it seems to me to make a lot of sense, but there's also the case in music, wasn't it? Because it seemed to mean a lot of music reviewers have no formal training in music at all, can't read music, have no training at all, and yet set themselves and yet essentially determine the careers of people who have training.
But not only critics, is it? I mean, if you look at the huge controversy we've just had, where composer who's doing the sort of producing former musicians and so on, and he's running the institute that Peter Garrett simply decided to cut off. He did that, I believe, because at Melbourne University, the people who are theorists have been trying to practice for many, many years. And it's simply an internal battle that you've seen going on. And you see, artists sort of absorb theory very fast, actually. It's not that they're either stupid or not interested. It's just that they think, oh, it's fine, that's a theory, and then go on with what they're doing and, you know, affects them or not. But theory is something that you can sort of put yourself on a text and also do very well with. And in particular, I think it is affecting music. It affects music teaching, certainly in Melbourne, yeah.
Well, going on from that, and comparing now with then, it seems that central to political life and the life of ideas, artists have, while there's never been more people in art galleries, and there's never been more individual, you know, Australians and probably in the world who've got real interest in the art, that artists no longer dictate ideas to the population in the same way.
Exactly.
And is this because they've been overtaken by popular culture, or is it that they've allowed the politics to go into the hands of others? I mean, is that too big a question?
I actually think that it's not just in arts that this happened. One of the things that the federal government, the whole federal government, was so small when it started, and it was for many, many years really almost, you know, in fact, entirely during the Menzies years, I think, there were small amateur, you know, committees of experts advising on virtually everything. And they really advised politicians on policy, and the public service put it into effect. And that was not only in the arts. I mean, the arts was, I think it was very good for politicians to be with artists, but they were also with scientists and with other people. And of course, what's happened, the other thing that's happened, and that's why the story really is why I put it in, that how could you possibly think now, as you're doing your media liaison, well, that's a good idea? There's an entire political class that grows, that is now between politicians and the rest of us. And remember that the Labour Party had no staff at all to speak of. They had one person in Canberra. Whitlam had, I think, three people on his staff. And they had, most of them had one secretary in their electoral office, and that was about it. And so for Bill Hayden to develop the Medicare project, he had to do so with doctors. And he found a group of doctors that, you know, whatever, and he went about the country finding people to talk to so he could develop the policy. And I assume he had other people helping him, but I don't actually know that for certain. And the other side of that was that if a politician, where you have a small group of people who are advising and who are the experts and who are advising the politician on whatever it is, I don't know, fisheries policy, the environment, whatever it is, and the politician producing the policy and trying to get it passed says, and we will do such and such, and these people don't like it and they're not being paid, they're actually their experts in their own field, their own field knows that they are advising. It's in their interests to say no. It's in their interests to be objective and fight and not to sort of try and... And I think that's actually, the political class is what we're dealing with in everybody.
There's a question here, then we go to Stuart. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you had the opportunity to encourage Rob Whitlam to buy Blue Coals.
The question is about whether Judith had encouraged Gough Whitlam to buy Blue Coals.
I have, this is really funny. I don't think I write about this in the book? I can't remember.
I don't think so.
So there I am one day, 2 hours, thank you. And the phone rings and Partridge says, well, look, I've been asked to buy this picture by an artist named Jackson Pollock, and it's a hell of a lot of money. I just don't know whether I should. I said, I've never heard of him. Well, to go back a bit, when I was a 15-year-old, my mother's best friend worked in an art gallery, and she decided that I should have some talent. And so at the age of 15, I was sent to a children's sort of art summer school. And this woman descended on the Children's Art Summer School at the National Gallery of Victoria, Justin O'Brien, who was teaching it, in tow, and said, look what she's done. Called me out of there to my intense embarrassment, just making some friends, and took me into this large room where there were only grown-ups, and one of them had no clothes on. And I had to draw this person and stuff. Hey, I've never known you as well. In the evenings, another grown-up came, and she was a woman called Mary Cecil Allen from New York, who was tutor to the Rothschild children, the Rothschild children, and who knew all of the expressionists, the American abstract expressionists. She had these incredible sides over the sides of that window that looked enormous. And she showed all these pictures, and of course she showed a lot of Jackson Pollock's and talked about action painting. So you know, that was my sort of 15-year-old experience more of what the grown-ups were talking about. So flash forward another 10 years, I answer the phone. And I say, no, everybody knows Jackson Pollock. William says, oh, all right, then, if that's it. He said, you think it would be all right? Oh, yes, I said, very famous. And I put down the phone. And Cliff came in about a few hours later, and I said, oh, Whitlam rang. And he said, oh, what do you want? And I said, well, he rang up and asked if he should buy that Jackson Pollock. Now, remember that I never said a word to Cliff about painting. He told me. And he's been offered a Jackson Pollock, and it's very expensive. And he wondered whether he should buy it. He said, oh, no, I don't think so. He said, I don't know what you can do at this stage, not the way things are going. And I said, why, Todd? He said, everybody knows who Jackson Pollock is. He said, how do you know who Jackson Pollock is? And I sort of had to think back, and I said, oh, no. And he said, Judith, nobody knows who Jackson Pollock is in this country, and it will be not a good idea if you rang up with him.
I was at school with Judith's brother, and I know all that fun was going on underneath St. Kilda. I would have spent some time there. That's pretty raunchy. Stuart.
Do you see some comparison between Whitlam and Keating in the sense that both of them were associated with the elite and both suffered? 75 and 77 for Whitlam and 96 for Pinking, huge backlashes from mainstream Australia. Do you see some comparison there? When Pinking gave out the Pinking grants and things like that for the arts, so I mean,
I think Paul Keating's a very sensitive man on some level, and he was a brilliant politician at least to start with. I mean, he lost the plot. I think
I think he expected to lose the election before, and he really didn't know what to do with it when he won it. I think, you know, that, I think that was what happened at that point. Have read Don Watson's book. I think, well, I think two things about it. I think Don Watson was also the problem. I think that you have to have somebody who can write, but they shouldn't be writing what... They shouldn't be encouraging you to be imaginative if you're imaginative. They should give you an opportunity to express imaginative things. But, you know, I don't think it was a good appointment. I think Watson's not got his feet on the ground in politics. He never hadn't had any political experience. He just came in as a writer. And I think that was what happened to Keating. Whitlam was a different kettle of fish. He was so unbelievably bad at judging character. And he inevitably put the round peg in the square peg in the round hole, always. I mean, I'll tell one of the stories in the book. So we went out to dinner one night after, you know, the dismissal had happened and everything. Although I remember bumping into somebody in the street, and he three persons sort of said what I was thinking. He said, "Oh, Christ, hello, do you recognize him?" And he said, "Isn't it appalling?" And I said, I thought he was really going to say it, and he said, "We have to vote for them again." I wouldn't have voted for him in 1975. I mean, I wanted the whole thing to go on because I think that would have been healthier. That it sort of either Bill Hayden became a decent treasurer and pulled it up, and Whitlam will, which I don't think he would. But I actually, you know, I think that most of the supporters were really, really secret by that stage, so erratic. And nobody had any idea that he would sort of surround himself with young people who were very erratic. I also think that Canberra itself is probably something that understood and looked out enough. The frustrated public servants who are going to get a bit between their teeth and give them advice and think that's a good idea. There was such a lot of good, very well thought out structural policy that people would have been perfectly happy with. They were expecting it, they knew there was going to be a change, and then you could have gone on in a dignified manner. But I think he was just an adolescent.
I should get back to talk on politics because
well said.
A lot of your comments are very perceptive. Now we're winding up towards the end. Can I just?
We should be prepared to discuss the contrast between the Melbourne and Sydney arts communities and destroy my beliefs that Sydney is divided by the harbour and we're a collection of separate cities. There's almost no such thing as Sydney. We're a centre and it's better organised.
Question about the difference between the Melbourne and the Sydney art communities and whether Sydney is divided by the harbour, unlike Melbourne, which doesn't have a harbour.
As a river.
That's a very beautiful day. I think it's such an enormous difference in the cities. Remember the Cliffs dealer was really common, so we were actually up in the Sydney art world at the time more. And I actually know nothing about the North Shore if there is an art world on it. I mean, I suppose we came... I suppose we came across some times, but isn't the Sydney division between Anglican evangelicals, you know, the Sydney Anglicans and the rest of the world, really? I mean, I think that's the... Isn't that the way Sydney works? I see Sydney, anthropologically, if you like, as a sort of in anthropology we have instated societies, which are laws, standing armies, something like the in Africa, where you have a standing army, diplomats, but you don't actually have writing, so you don't have laws coming historically down. It's all happening in the present, as it were, although there's traditions. Think of the New South Wales Corps as sort of that section as a level. And I think of the uninstated society being the Aboriginal people in the convicts in Sydney. And then the stated society being the Navy who came out, who were the intellectuals at the time, of course, the Navy being the technology before information technology, before the Industrial Revolution. It was the Navy where everything was happening. And so with those three levels in Sydney, you have a constant sort of weirdo interaction where nobody really has to believe in the law or constancy or consistency. Whereas in Sydney, because we were settled by
Melbourne.
I'm sorry, by something, but in Melbourne we were settled very largely by Scots,
driven Protestants, very principled people, and they tended to be rather left-wing, not as sort of others. So you've got this very much, and this later, it's got all the 19th century ideas of smaller liberalism coming in. It's how I see the two cities. As to the art world, you see, it's changed so much. I feel terribly old. You see, I was with somebody 20 years older than me. But I feel like my own grandmother quite often. It's changed so much. It's so hideous. You get the most pretentious people who say they're artists now, where they weren't before. You know? And you get wonderful people who are just like the artists then. And do you think there's actually...
Don't answer you. The answer.
There is an artist from the North Shore, Grace Cossington Smith.
There's an artist from the North Shore, and there's an art gallery at Boston.
No, she's dead now.
But is there an art world? That's a different...
Oh, that's another world.
Don't. Front row says there is. Finally, tell us a bit about... Oh, you have said a bit already, but a bit about Clifton. I mean, obviously, he's... a brilliant artist, but obviously a very troubled man, difficult man, erratic man. In your experience, are many artists like that, or is there something particular about him? Let's talk a bit about him. You spent 10 years. Would you do it again?
Oh yeah, do it again. I'm particularly now older, actually. I wouldn't say erratic. No, I mean, he was focused and terrifically intelligent. I realised the other day, as I was writing this, in fact, I put it in an art book now, his grandfather was a man named Ernest Cook, who chose not to take the South Australian scholarship, but to stay, now this is in the 19th century, not to take the South Australian scholarship, but to stay in South Australia and work with Todd. And it was because, those of you who, the time, the telegraph, was like the IT industry, if you know. But Cliff's father came out to Australia before the First World War with a diesel locomotive. Now, I sort of said this the other day to a friend of mine who's into cars. He said, Christ, you wouldn't have any trouble at school. What does that mean? He said, would it be like your father designing a Formula One engine or even a spacecraft? So here's Cliff, he's got these two men. Genes of both of them, but also the experience of both of them, and they are men who are absolutely internationally at the top of their profession. I mean, his grandfather had all this international fame, and he has a very comfortable childhood, and his father decides to accept an offer to go and design the first diesel rail locomotive in Queensland, having been head of the Victorian Railway Design Department. And they had a proper farm. And they go up and they live there for 2 years. He gives up his pension rights and he has lost a lung in the First World War. So he's to get out of the army early. He gives up his army pension rights and goes on with his son. And at a very, quite a young age, he suddenly dies. He dies the day he goes back to his office and dies. And one day when it's, I don't know, the design submission was over. And here is Cliff, a young man, 13, who knows he wants to be an artist, who's never had to think about the Depression, in the middle of the Depression. This is 1938 when he's 13. And it's a devastating thing for him. He always talked about it. He always resented his father leaving the army early. Now, he did it himself, of course, later on. So he didn't have too much trouble. I mean, he was sent off to one term at school and his mother couldn't afford it. And so he went off and got him a job in Adelaide and lived with the family there, which is how he started a driving school. And he goes into the army. And there's a John Percival portrait of him after he comes out of the army. He looks like a little angel. He must have been the most sensitive, shy little boy. And he gets very toughened up. But he gets so toughened up that he becomes a sort of extraordinary entrepreneur. He runs the black market with a friend because they get off the boat and they're unloading sugar from the boat when they're coming. This is to be an occupied trip in Japan, it's in Hiroshima, 3 weeks after the bomb was dropped. They get off there being
5 troops and they're unloading sugar. And suddenly a Japanese comes up to him with a whole 5-pound English notes and says, can you get every fifth bang up that street with people waiting? And he says, I'll have to ask him mate. So he goes up and says to his mate, what about it? And they say, yes. So up every fifth he goes. So he starts the back market dealings with these people. He runs two up school. They decide they go to one of his lectures that they're given on sleeping with women. So they buy a brothel, and they say to the women in the brothel, you can have regular customers. But they buy, make certain that they get second-class geishas. The first-class geishas don't sleep with the second-class geishas. They buy, well, these women are starving, everybody's starving. And they, so they do a deal, and they're allowed to have a few Japanese businessmen. But so he then learns about sex from these women, and then he and his friend decide that it would be fun to go. They're sort of bored, really, in Japan, and so they decide that it would be good to go and fight with Ho Chi Minh. So they start getting, they get a boat, and they start putting rifles in it. And he's sitting in the barracks one night. His friend goes off and says that they're usually, two of them are supposed to be on security duty taking messages from him. He said, do you mind doing this all tonight? I'm not well. So he goes off with his girlfriend and leaves good there. And the telephone, and he said, it's the Americans, and they say, look, there are two Australian people. They've got this half filled with ammunition. We're about to catch them tomorrow night. Let them. Then they want to have him drop behind the lines to Mao. Well, there's another story about that. That didn't work. And then he comes back and he decides he wants to be a painter. He had very appalling experiences. He did very bad things during the war, very bad things in the war. And that tortured him, tormented him for a long time. He didn't let him stop him doing what he wanted. He didn't let him stop him focusing on being a painter. I think what it did was to make him focus on being a painter in a sense and nothing else, nothing else. If he'd gone this far, then what he would do is entirely work had been created. I don't think he saw it as reparation. And so it was very difficult because I realised it was some truth. It probably took me a long time to talk about it. That was very hard. But you see, he was so intelligent and so interesting to be with. And it was so... I was much younger than him. And in those days, one of the things about being me at that time is that Clyde Holding offered Cliff a seat in the Victorian Upper House. I'm the political strategist, and I'm the one who's a mind speaking in public. And Cliff gets off. It was about being a woman and not being noticed. You know? But with him, I was able to go anywhere. And he was so effective. We were standing on an Italian railway station one day, trying to buy a ticket. And I carefully written down the name and practiced with the people in the hotel the name of the destination. I knew I was saying it right, because I would hear other people saying it. And I was just trying to buy this ticket, and Cliff was standing beside me. And he said, he's a bureaucrat, he needs a piece of paper. And he took a piece of paper out of his notebook and said, wrote bureaucrat on it, and handed it to the guy, who stapled it to the back of something. Oh, we got the ticket. It was fantastic, you know, that sort of thing. He made things happen if he wanted. And of course, it was a terrific life. If you wanted to meet somebody, you'd see somebody on television who was interesting, David Frost, for instance. And he'd say, oh, would you like to pay me? And he'd say, oh, yes, go for it. And I'd bring them up, or I'd make contact. And he went up to David Frost. No, what to get to. But I mean, you know, it was a wonderful and interesting life. And I had a sort of salon, if you like, you know, where everybody came. But Christina Steve came and stayed with us. People would, because also we love, you know, I love cooking and having people. So that, and we were in the country, and we were the, you know, place where foreign affairs brought people. So a lot of people came up to see the mud bricks and things. And it was a very committed life, I suppose, too. I mean, I didn't ever use detergent. We had no hose to the garden, birds and cocks. Not really. That was a joke. But I mean, you know, it was all very much about trying to live in the environment. And of course, there were the wombats.
Many thanks. Take a seat. We've gone 5 minutes over, but I think people would have gone half an hour over, so it's all good. And I'll be very brief, because some of the stories that Jesus has told today are in the book, and I said, Jennifer Grundy's got some coffees outside.
some have heard him for the first time, including the one, thanks for the question, I think on Blue Coles, who heard him for the first time. But beyond that, that was an important analysis of art and politics in the 1970s, and I'm sure that your thesis will in turn become another book, and we'd like to have you back sometime. But for tonight, well done.
Thank you.
Best wishes.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again.